Hey there, folks. Caleb coming to you with a very, very special opportunity. If you're trying to learn more about your awareness on the land, whether it's tracking, weather understanding, bird language, or just becoming better and more tuned in the environments that you frequent, there is a very cool online course that you can attend, organized and developed and taught by my very good friend and previous special guest on our podcast, Chris Gilmore. The program is called Nature's Forgotten Language, and if you attend the course and you go to the checkout, you can use our promo code BUSHCRAFT, BUSHCRAFT, and you will get a 20% discount on the course. And of course, in that process, you'll be helping us here at the podcast at Canadian Bushcraft. Now, this is a very cool opportunity, and you can find it at the Changing World Project website, www.changingworldproject.com.
To know the landscape is to open up a door, to feel deeper connected than you've ever felt before. We know that you will love this podcast, so shut your mouth and listen to Canadian Bushcraft.
Hello, Dragonfly Nation. This is the Canadian Bushcraft Podcast with your host, Caleb Musgrave, coming to you yet again with some knowledge-focused information. We're not going to be going too much into gear in this episode. We're going to be talking mostly about knowledge. So I'm expecting to see a little bit of a dip in our ratings and a dip in our viewership, or listeners. And then it'll come back at some point when we do another gear talk, because those seem to be the ones that get us the most viewers. But for those of you that are faithful and loyal and want to learn, this is an episode for you. We're going to be talking about firewood. We're going to be talking about specifically how to keep yourself warm this winter with firewood, whether that's on that brand new homestead that you got just before COVID-19 kicked into high gear or right after. Or, you know, maybe you already live in an old cabin or an old house that has a wood stove or a wood furnace outdoors, like an external wood furnace, or maybe you even have an old fireplace at your home and you want to have a nice fire this winter to keep the place warm, to keep the place toasty, to celebrate the holidays, whatever it may be. Or maybe you're getting brave enough to go out and winter camp. This is an episode for you. We're going to be talking all about firewood on every level we possibly can, from the scientific basis of what makes wood burn and why does this kind of wood burn better than that kind of wood, all the way to techniques of how to find dry firewood, all the way to what is exactly a BTU versus a calorie and all these kinds of things and a joule and all these crazy things and how to store firewood and cut firewood for the wintertime so you can stockpile. All this information is coming to you today on the Canadian Bushcraft Podcast. Now, when it comes to firewood, not all woods are created equal. Some woods really burn really well for a long time. Other ones burn really bright for a short while, and others just plain suck. So how can we help remember and how can we help learn what woods are best for firewood? Well, first, we can dive into BTUs and stuff. I want to do that in a minute, and that's going to help us really understand at a scientific quantifiable level what woods are best to burn for a wood stove or a hearth or a campfire. It'll help us learn those things. But one of the easiest ways is to look at old nursery rhymes and poems. One of them from England was known as the firewood rhyme, and there's a bunch of versions of this. The one that I have is from I believe Lady Celia Congreve, originally published in the Times back in 1930, around March 2nd, I believe. And the way it goes is along these lines. Beechwood fires are bright and clear if the logs are kept a year. Chestnuts only good, they say, if for logs 'tis laid away. Make a fire of elder tree, death within your house will be. But ash new or ash old is fit for a queen with crown of gold. Birch and fir logs burn too fast, blaze bright and do not last. It is by the Irish said, hawthorn bakes the sweetest bread. Elmwood burns like churchyard mold, even the very flames are cold. But ash green or ash brown is fit for a queen with golden crown. Poplar gives a bitter smoke, fills your eyes and makes you choke. Applewood will scent your room, pearwood smells like flowers in bloom. Oaken logs, if dry and old, keep away the winter's cold. But ash wet or ash dry, a king shall warm his slippers by. So that little poem, there's a bunch of different versions of it. There's even like nursery rhymes with a song to it. There's so many different versions of that poem. But what they're getting at is pretty much along the lines of what the varied quality of different woods are. Poplar puts out an acrid smoke. I can vouch for that, as does willow. Oak burns really, really long and bright and hot, but only if it's been seasoned well. And we'll be talking about seasoning in a bit. It's a little bit different than seasoning your steak. They're talking about how great smelling applewood and pearwood are and other fruit woods, all the while describing in almost every other verse how amazing ash is, the ash tree, Fraxinus. Ash is kind of this miracle tree that you can actually cut it down when green, fresh, with leaves on the branches. And if you cut it up well and peel the bark off, it will burn. Most other trees won't do that. They will either sputter and smoke and like basically singe over and char over and that's about it. Or they just produce a ton of smoke and it's acrid and bitter and it takes forever to burn through. Ash, when you cut it and split it, it will burn. I've taken wrist-thick trees, big branches off of a tree that we're cutting down for other reasons, and I've cut them right up into firewood and tossed them right on the fire after pulling the bark off them, and it burns like a champ. If you want to understand more what we're talking about there, you can go back to the trees episode of the podcast. We'll be getting a little bit more into what we're talking about on that episode today in this episode when we're diving into like wood selection. So what this rhyme is doing is giving you a good idea of wood selection. Elm will burn very cool. It basically burns like coal. So you're going to have some heat down there, but you're not going to feel it up where you are. It's going to be burning inside the fire pretty good, but not where you need the heat. Birch will burn bright, but it doesn't last the whole night. All that kind of stuff, these rhymes and poems are really important to know when coming down to understanding what firewood you need or what kind of firewood to choose. So before we go real deep into what kind of woods to choose and this and this and that and that and that, let's talk about the basic way how we measure the heat value of woods, of certain woods, of all woods. The most common form used in the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom is the form of BTU, and that's a heat measurement system. British thermal units, or BTUs, are basically a very old form using the concept of Fahrenheit and the imperial system of measurements of the metric system. The BTU is basically how much heat is required to raise 1 pound of water by 1 degree Fahrenheit. Okay, so 5 BTUs would be bringing it up 5 degrees, that pound of water, bringing it up by 5 degrees in a certain amount of time and all that kind of understanding. Calories are the metric form of that, and it would be approximately 252 calories for every British thermal unit. Basically, a calorie is how much heat is required to raise 1 gram of water by 1 degree Celsius. Okay, same concept, one and one, but in a metric form. So 1 gram of water raised 1 degree Celsius is a calorie, okay? And a BTU is 1 pound of water raised by 1 degree Fahrenheit. Now, the International Standard of Measurement Units, or International System of Units, or SI, which is the French acronym, I suppose, or SI, is measured in joules. And so a BTU is approximately 252 calories, okay? 252 calories is 1 BTU, or British thermal unit. 1,055 joules is 1 BTU. And that's why a lot of people go by the BTU system, the British thermal unit, because it's a big, big number. And when we're talking about wood and BTUs and heat forms, like the best way to explain it is, well, the basic way to explain it is, if we're looking at like, I'm going to the wood, Utah State University Forestry Extension website on wood heating. For example, one dry cord of wood of alder is 17.5 million BTUs. Okay. That's why they go with a big, big number like the British thermal unit, even though Canada and the and England are mostly metric. We will go by kilometers. We'll go by kilograms. We'll go by calories. We'll go by Celsius, all that stuff. But when it comes down to measuring the heat value of a piece of wood, it's even in BTUs, which is a massive number or massive unit of measurement, it's still for just a single cord of wood, which is going to be, let's say, alder, is going to be 17.5 million BTUs. So that would be in the tens of millions of, calories, and potentially the thousands, like the billions, potentially in joules. So BTU is the most common way that we measure heat from firewood. All right. So when you hear me say BTU throughout this whole episode, whenever you hear that, just remember it's a British thermal unit, which is a that is the measurement of how much heat it requires to raise 1 pound of water by 1 degree Fahrenheit. Okay, that's all you got to remember. So with all that measurement out of the way and the little cute rhyme that I did at the beginning, let's get into understanding the selecting of firewood. We have two general categories of wood. We have hardwood and we have softwood. And that's a really... that's mostly from the lumber industry itself, softwoods being your coniferous trees, hardwoods being your deciduous trees. That term, softwood versus hardwood, gets really kind of convoluted when you're looking at the extremes of both. White spruce and yew wood are very dense woods compared to basswood and poplar. So basswood and poplar being deciduous trees are categorized as hardwood, but they're softer than two coniferous trees, spruce, specifically the white spruce, and yew. They're softer than those trees. And yet those are considered softwood. So when you hear the term softwood and hardwood, they're trying to get you to understand deciduous versus coniferous trees. So if you get an order, let's say you order in a cord of hardwood, mixed hardwood, you shouldn't see pine and spruce in that mix. That's the basic way that it's going to be explained. If you get a cord of softwood, you shouldn't be finding any maple or oak or birch in that wood pile. So keep that in mind. Softwood is usually looked at as coniferous trees, and hardwood is usually looked at as a deciduous tree. When we go into that, people will say hardwood burns better than softwood, and you're going to want a lot of hardwood for your wood stove. That's true. And the reason being is, softwoods are going to be, first and foremost, they're going to be much lighter and they're going to be much softer, which means they get burned through much faster. They burn up really quick. If you take a pound of cedar wood and shave that up and get that kindled and get that burning, and that's burning there, and then you take a pound of oak and you do the same thing, the oak will continue to burn longer than the cedar wood will, even though they weigh the same, because it's going to burn, and it's going to burn, you know, the softwood will burn hotter for a short time. It's a really good kindling. Most fires that I start in the woods, that I start at home, when I start in a wood stove, whatever system it is, most of the time I'm using kindling made out of softwood, whether it's pine or cedar are my preferences. But I'll use spruce. I will use tamarack if I have it, although tamarack in its own right is very dense. I'll use those softer woods, and then I will use their real high heat output that's very immediate to start kindling thinner pieces of hardwood like maple and oak on top of them to get that stuff burning hot so that it can start to burn for a long time. And then I'll be introducing larger and larger pieces of firewood that are usually hardwood. So that's the general rule of thumb. That's not always the case. When I was living in Wyoming, back in 2014, we noticed that the gamble oak, which is a very common oak tree out there, it's a very small oak tree, but it's a very common one, burns worse than the ponderosa pine out there and the poplar and birch out there. So the ponderosa pine burned better than their technically the densest wood they had, which was oak. It burned better and it burned longer. Often the oak, even though it was well seasoned for several years and it was shaved up nice and fine, for some reason it just would not hold a flame very well. So there's a lot of variables out there. Don't take everything as gospel. You've got to kind of experiment and experience the woods in your environment. Where I live, the better woods we have for long fires are oak, ash, and maple. We do have some hickory, and hickory is an amazing firewood. It smells nice, it burns long, and it burns bright. It holds good coals for cooking on, all those kinds of benefits. But it's not a very common wood, whereas we have a ton of oak around me, a ton of maple, and a ton of ash. And so we'll burn that most of the time. We're usually burning those three species. Now, going into the understanding of softwood versus hardwood, there's sometimes when you don't want a long burning fire, or you don't want a fire that's going to take a while to heat up. We want immediate heat, and it doesn't need to last very long. Great examples of that is if I fell through the ice. I need a twig bundle made of conifer branches of like cedar, fir, pine, spruce, whatever I've got, coniferous branches, made into a massive, massive hug size bundle, like the size of a trash can, like an outdoor trash can. And I'm going to light that on fire because I need that stuff to dry me off and warm me up as fast as possible. That's called a warming drying fire. I need immediate heat now. And that's going to dry my body off, dry my clothes if I hang them around the fire while I'm standing there in my long johns and my base layers. And I'm going to warm my body up so I don't go hypothermic. That's when I'm going to want that immediate heat, that immediate action of a conifer wood or softwood. Is it going to last very long? No, but it's going to get me warm enough that I can start grabbing other pieces of wood that'll keep the fire going for a while. And that'll keep me warm for longer. If I started off, shivering, soaking wet, and I've got to get that fire going, starting off with stuff like oak and maple could take a while to get that fire really hot. And in that time, I could start to lose my heat rapidly, and it would take a lot longer to recover from that heat loss. Another good example of when we may just want to have an immediate fire that burns bright and hot and fast and then burns down to practically nothing is cooking fires when we're on the move. If I am having a lunch spot while I'm deer hunting and I'm just going to cook up a meal, heat up my coffee, get a pot of water boiling, I don't necessarily want long burning coals like hickory and oak and maple. On the other hand, I may just want fast burning wood that gets the water hot so I can get my coffee going or get my soup started or bring the rice to a boil and then let it simmer down slow and low really quickly, whatever the meal may be when I'm on the move, because I'm not going to be staying there for long. I also want the fire to go out very soon so I don't have to do a lot of work to put the fire out. All right. So I don't have to go out and get a ton of water and dump it on the firewood. I want to go right to ash, not have a lot of long living coals. That is where softer woods can be my friend. Bunch of twigs from a cedar tree or a pine tree, or even poplar, which is going to burn up real fast, real hot, and then go to ash and not really produce any coals. That's a good example of when I would want those bright burning, kindling kind of softer woods. In comparison to the obvious answers of when do I want a long burning fire, when I want to stay warm for a long time, or when I'm cooking a meal, making a big dinner. I want a lot of coals that I can work around with and adjust and potentially use around my cooking ovens, my camp ovens, sometimes referred to as cast iron Dutch ovens, or if I'm using a reflector oven, or if I'm doing roasting or braising or broiling, whatever it may be, or just warming my house. That's when I'm going to want to use those denser hardwoods to keep me warm and keep my meal warm for a long time. Now, in my defense, I'm a bit of a firewood nerd. I'm often fascinated by, as most of you probably know, I'm a tree nerd. I love trees in general. I'm a dendrophile. I love studying trees and analyzing trees. And that kind of goes back to the days of learning how to make fire all the time and understanding why did this wood burn better than that wood and why is this going to be beneficial for me. And it also goes back to when I was a kid. When I was like 8 or 9 years old, my dad ordered in 2 cords of wood to heat our house for the winter instead of paying an electrical bill for all of our, because we had electric baseboard heaters. And that's expensive. That's very expensive. Whereas wood can be fairly cheap. I think currently 2 cords of wood, mixed hardwood in my region is averaging around $600 for 2 cords of wood. And if your house is well insulated and you've got a good, efficient wood stove or wood furnace, 2 cords can get you through most of the winter for a warm season. Some houses and some insulation with poorer insulation or more drafts, and maybe the fire, the wood stove or the fireplace isn't as efficient of burning. You may require, you know, 5-6 cords of wood. I know some people where I've cut wood for aunties of mine and stuff, they were going through about a cord of wood a month, and that would be starting in November and going all the way into late April. So that's a lot of wood that they were going through just because their house was very drafty, or their wood stove wasn't very efficient, or it was too small of a wood stove for how big the house was. So they were constantly having to burn wood in small batches to keep the place warm. And so I've had a fascination with understanding firewood for a long time. So I've got a lot of books in my collection, and I've got a lot of websites and research points that I've had for years now, understanding to help me understand firewood better. One of the best ones that have come out in the last few years is a reprint from Lars Meiding from Norway called Norwegian Wood, Chopping, Stacking, and Drying Wood the Scandinavian Way. Really, really good read explaining the self-sufficiency of burning firewood, but also like all the techniques and safety, but also the understanding of how to store the wood. So I'll be referring to it off and on throughout this episode. Another great book, which is really kind of hard to find these days, it hasn't really been reprinted in a long time, is a book, a kind of a textbook or manual from when it was referred to as the Ministry of Resources and Development, which is nowadays known as the MNRF, Ministries of Natural Resources and Forestry. And the book is called, from the forestry branch, Canadian Woods, Their Properties and Uses. And if you're looking for it now, this book averages $300 trying to find this book nowadays. I was lucky enough to find it for like $15 at a thrift store one day. Nobody knew what its actual value was, and I cherish this book. It gives you a ton of details on not just firewood, but also like the porosity of woods, the densities of woods, the longevity of wood, understanding like how much compression resistance it may have versus how much tensile strength it might have, knowing how rot resistant it may be. What you can use these woods for is basically what the entire manual or textbook is about. So hickory is good for axe handles, and it's good for veneers, and it's good for hockey sticks and all these other fascinating things that we use hickory for. Whereas we'll use birch to make veneer and plywood and all that kind of stuff. And fir will be mixed in with other woods to make a good laminate like plywood or particle board. But with fir, it's much more rot prone. So it's not going to be very long lasting plywood. It's more particle board kind of material that you want to use on the interior of a building, not on the exterior of a building. That's the kind of work that textbook goes through. Canadian Woods, Their Properties and Uses from the Forestry Division of what's now known as the MNRF, Ministry of Natural Resources and Forestry. But back then was known as the Ministries of Resources and Development. So those are some great books on it. There's also a couple of websites I would recommend. There's the Wood Database website that most folks that are wood turners and wood carvers and wood workers will easily find just by typing in online in a search engine, Wood Database. It'll pop up pretty quick. The one that I was referring to earlier when I was talking about explaining BTUs is the Utah State University Forestry Extension, or forestry.usu.edu. All right. And they have a wood heating article from Michael Kunz which is an extension forestry specialist, as well as Tom Schmidt, who's a forester. So this whole breakdown of BTUs was written up by two gentlemen who did a lot of research into the woods of basically the Utah area, but as well as the eastern woodlands, understanding their BTUs for firewood specifically. So those are a lot of good sources. You can also just start Googling, what BTUs does pine have? What BTUs does alder have? What BTUs does oak have? And that kind of stuff will start giving you answers. Doing your own due diligence and researching, finding any book on wood cutting. There's a few books called like The Urban Woodcutter or The Urban Lumberjack. There's Intro to Being a Lumberjack. There's also The Urban Woodcutter. All these phenomenal, phenomenal texts and tomes on being able to understand how to cut wood, but also how to select the wood you want to cut for firewood. There's this kind of like interesting paradox happening in a lot of urban landscapes, a lot of cities and suburbs, where people are wanting to use the wood that they're seeing in their neighborhoods getting trimmed off by arborists or being cut down by electrical companies or Hydro One. And they're seeing this wood just kind of get stacked. It's like free to a good home kind of thing, where the wood is free. And you could go out with a pickup truck, a tow chain, and a handsaw and gather up all this wood for free and heat your house with it. All the while, a lot of suburbs and urban areas are trying to do away with wood stoves and wood furnaces and all that stuff inside the home. And it's getting harder and harder every year in Canada to get permission or get permits or get basically wet certified to have a wood stove in your home. So it's a strange little paradox. Like, you have all this firewood that's free to a good home to use, but you can't use it. Add the fact that a lot of urban areas won't let you have even an outdoor fire. You can't even have a bonfire in your backyard in many places. In Peterborough, there is no legal right to have an outdoor fire, an external open fire. You don't have the legal right to. You're not allowed to burn it. Even if you're, a lot of people say there's like this kind of myth, like, oh, as long as you got some hot dogs with you. No, the fire must be fully enclosed. It has to be a completely enclosed fire. It can't be out in the open in the Peterborough region. So be mindful of that. That yes, you can go and get all the firewood you want for free, but are you allowed to burn it? And that's like it's this kind of sad catch 22 that we're in, because I understand why they don't want it. It's harder to insure these houses because, to be frank, firewood is actually a very dangerous way to heat a house. You can easily, if something goes wrong, too much creosote is deposited in the stove pipe, or you get a blockage somewhere. You can easily cause everything from a house fire to carbon monoxide poisoning. It's a very risky way to heat a house. And in comparison to something like an electric baseboard heater or propane furnaces, it's very difficult to challenge that argument that it's unsafe. Add the fact for environmental factors, people will argue that in some municipalities and some city bylaws, they'll state the fact that the smoke itself is carcinogenic and it can be very acrid and it can be very harmful to those with breathing issues, people that have asthma, COPD, emphysema, et cetera. It's true. Wood smoke can be very, very triggering and very damaging to their breathing. And we have to think about our neighbors. So I'm not going to argue why you should have a wood stove or a furnace in your house as wood burning, but it is not something that we should be afraid of. It's something we should just become more knowledgeable about and understand. If you have the time and you have the resources to construct and have installed a very efficient outdoor external wood furnace, I see no reason why you shouldn't have it in your home. And a lot of insurance companies, home insurance companies, would rather you have an external wood furnace instead of an indoor wood fire or a wood stove or fireplace. Because if the wood furnace catches on fire, and it's away from your building, then the house doesn't burn down, or is at least less likely to burn down. So I get the reasoning. I get the logic. What I want to get at, though, is understanding the wood itself and why we choose the wood. You have a lot of options out there. One of the main reasons we don't want to use softwood, I was talking about softwood versus hardwood a moment ago. One of the main reasons we don't want to use too much softwood in our wood fire is the creosote risk. Creosote is a deposit of very combustible residue that is going to form on the inside of a wood stove. And anytime there's an angle or a bend or a kink or a twist in that stovepipe or in that chimney, or there's any like little blemish, that's where creosote can deposit. It can land on there and start to build up. And it's kind of like plaque on your teeth. You don't brush your teeth enough, that's what's going to start building up. Think about back in Mary Poppins, you have the chimney sweep character. Chimney sweeps existed to make sure that your house didn't burn down. They would go in with these big brushes from the top and brush the inside of your chimney and scrape away all that creosote. If you have a wood stove, we've had it on occasion in our camp, in our winter tents, where if someone's been burning something like pine for a while in the woods over hemlock, Lord help me with burning hemlock. it will start, you'll actually have to go up to the wood stove at least twice a day and basically tap on it on the stovepipe with a stick or an axe handle and knock the creosote out of there before you light the fire again, because it makes a deposit. Whenever you have an inefficient burn, let's say there's a lot of water in the firewood, it's very wet firewood, or it's got a lot of resins in it, something like pine or spruce, they're going to start making these creosote deposits more likely than something that is well-seasoned, clean, burning hardwood. So when we talk about something like softwood, one of the major reasons we don't want this is the creosote deposit. So what's the danger of creosote? Well, basically, this stuff is a fairly combustible residue that is coating the inside of your stovepipe or chimney. And eventually, that stuff's going to light up. And it's going to burn like white phosphorus. It's going to burn very, very hot. You're dealing with combustible gas residue materials. The same stuff that makes the flames of your fire is what this stuff is. When we actually look at a piece of firewood that's burning, the wood itself is not actually in flames. What's happening is the wood is heating up enough that it starts to off-gas combustible resins and combustible gases. And that stuff is then catching a light. That's why the flame seems to dance on the wood. And as that gas and all those volatile oils and resins and rosins are being extracted by the heat source through pyrolysis, the separation by fire, pyrolysis, what's remaining is carbon, which becomes charcoal. That's what, why the wood turns black. It always was black, but that was just the carbon that was in the wood. And as everything else is getting drawn out, the carbon gets left behind. And eventually the carbon starts to burn as well, and that's what we call coals. That's what we call charcoal. That's what we call the coals of a fire, is the burning, glowing carbon. And finally, when that is finally removed and extracted and burned off in the form of carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide, you're left with ash, which is mostly potassium nitrate and other trace minerals and chemicals that just don't burn off very well. And that's what wood ash is. That's what the ash left in the fire, in the fireplace is, or the fire pit or the wood stove or the hearth. And so as that stuff is going up the chimney or up the stovepipe in your home or in your tent, every time that pipe bends, a little bit of that, you know, combustible gas or residue gets deposited and it starts to build up and cake up like plaque on your teeth. And if you don't do your due diligence to knock that stuff out of there, scrape that out of there, brush that out of there, eventually it builds up enough that when, let's say you have a nice hot burning hardwood fire, some flames kind of dance up the wood stove a bit, it catches that stuff alight and you have what's called a chimney fire. And that's when things can go really, really bad, really, really, really fast. So where do we see the most creosote deposits? What kind of wood is going to give us that? Things that have a lot of resins or residues in them that burn off, that are very combustible. Or dirty burning wood, or poorly burning wood that's creating a lot of smoke, because the smoke is uncombusted resins, rosins, and other residues and compounds. So if you have a bunch of pine and spruce and cedar, and that's what you're burning all the time in your wood stove, you're going to want to shake that chimney or shake that stovepipe as often as possible, clean it out, clear it out, and preferably burn some dry hardwood in there instead. But it's not always just the softwoods. Yes, the softwoods have a lot of creosote deposits or potential, but so does green firewood. If you take green hardwood like maple, oak, ash, any of that stuff, and you're cutting that up and burning that in your wood stove or your fireplace, and it's fairly wet, it's going to have an inefficient burn and it's going to produce more smoke, which again is carbon deposits, creosote deposits, combustible deposits in your stovepipe or chimney. And once that stuff lights up, you have a chimney fire. So creosote comes in many forms. Don't just think it's just pine and spruce and other softwoods. Hardwoods can make them as well. So the best solution for that is cutting and seasoning hardwood for the wintertime and only using softwood to kindle the fire, to get it burning, okay? Don't ever depend on just spruce and fir and pine for the whole winter in your wood stove and not clean it out thoroughly. If that's all you got around you, sometimes that's the case. Sometimes you're just stuck with softwoods. Multiple times when I was out winter camping in the boreal forest, all we could find was fir and spruce. There was no birch around to cut. There was no alder around to cut. There was no maple or oak to cut. So we depended on softwoods. And what we would end up doing is, as I mentioned earlier, take a handle of an axe or take a stick and tap away and knock away at our stovepipe on a regular daily basis, if not multiple times a day. And we would do it every time we went to relight the stove. Even if we had just the fire burning like an hour and a half before and it's just gone out. Before we rekindle it, we tap away. And you're going to hear what sounds like metallic snowflakes coming down the stovepipe. That's the deposits of creosote and other carbonous material that can easily combust. You have to take this stuff seriously. You have to take creosote seriously. That's why most houses do not have wood stoves anymore, because it's so dangerous, the creosote deposits. So let's get back into real talk about firewood. So let's talk about a scenario where we're going to be cutting our own firewood. Maybe we just got our own homestead. Maybe we're out winter camping, whatever the reason is. Let's just make this a very simple scenario. We're going out looking for firewood. Let's say we have no time to stockpile for last season, or maybe like it's that scenario as well. We're going out looking for firewood. Let's start with the first scenario. We're going out. It's just coming up to this time of year, November, and we just got our house kind of figured out, our homestead on the land, or we're going winter camping. Let's stick with that scenario for now. It's pretty much the same if we're going out in the winter or the spring to cut firewood for next year, but we're going to start from scratch, okay? Let's pretend that you already know how to fell trees safely. You have all the proper equipment for safety for that, your personal protection equipment, your PPE, like your felling helmet, your visor, your safety glasses, your safety gloves, your chainsaw chaps, if you're using a chainsaw or if you're using an axe and handsaws, all the safety equipment for that. And preferably you have someone else with you that also knows what they're doing. You always should be cutting or felling trees only if you have people with you. It's very dangerous to drop a tree when there's no one around to save you, perform first aid, warn you that the tree's falling the wrong way, or at least call 911. All right? So make sure there's someone with you, please. And let's pretend you have the equipment to get the wood out of there. You have chains, you have tow chains, you have straps, maybe you have a come along or a winch system. Maybe you have a truck or an ATV that has a hauling system on the back of it or a trailer of some sort. Whatever the methods are, let's pretend we have all the equipment we need to fell wood. We just need to think about what wood we want. Going out on the land and choosing firewood, we're going to be looking at preferably dead standing hardwood. That's the best. We don't want to be getting firewood from the ground. Regardless of whether it's camping for a bonfire or cutting firewood for the wintertime for camping in the winter, or it's getting firewood for the house, you don't want to be collecting dead wood off the ground. The main reason is gravity draws water to the ground. When it rains, the rain doesn't go upwards, it goes downwards. And so when water is being deposited on things, it's going to deposit on things mostly that are on the ground. So you're going to have a lot of water in that wood. And with water comes decomposition, aka rot. So if I'm looking for really smoky wood, I'm going to look for wood that's on the ground. If I'm trying to smoke a moose hide or smoke a deer hide, or I'm smoke treating wood for curing, which is a traditional Anishinaabeg method of speed drying wood or speed seasoning wood to make into projects like a hunting bow or a canoe paddle, will smoke the wood. I'm going to look for wood on the ground for that because it's going to be rotted. It's going to be really punky. It's going to have a lot of water content in it. So it's going to create that creosote that we really want for those things. That's not what we want for our wood stove or our bonfire. So we're looking for standing dead wood. It doesn't have to be perfectly vertical, but the more vertical it is, the more likely it'll be dry. The more it starts to angle or lean, the more surface area makes contact with that rain falling from the sky, and the more places it can land, right? We're creating more surface area for the water to collect on and penetrate through. So perfectly vertical wood is best. When you look at that tree, preferably hardwood, we want to be looking at those hardwoods. We want to be looking for things like maple and ash and oak that are standing dead. We kind of want to avoid birch. Most dead standing birch is going to be rotted. Birch rots very fast. If I go out in the woods and I cut down a birch tree and I get all the birch bark off it, I need to make baskets and canoes and all those beautiful things that we do with birch bark. And then I take some wood to making a canoe paddles and making a bowls and spoons and cups and everything for carving. I'm going to have a lot of wood left behind still, and that could be my firewood. But if I leave it for more than a couple of months, especially in wet summer conditions, it's going to rot really fast. I remember spring of 2014, we had to fell a birch tree that was kind of leaning in a bad location. It was going to drop on top of where our camp location was. And so we dropped it. We cut it down with a chainsaw and we bucked it up and we took a bunch of chunks of wood out of it to make into kuksas and spoons and bowls. And we took a bunch of beautiful bark off of it. And then we stacked it right there in the woods. We're like, I'm going to come back to that in the winter or the fall, and it should be nicely seasoned for me. And I left that summer to go to Wyoming. So we cut it in around, I'd say, April or May. I think it was actually April. And we stacked it, you know, up on top of some other wood so it wasn't touching the ground. But we didn't cover it, and we didn't put it inside somewhere safe and dry away from the rain. And I left for Wyoming about a month and a half later. And I didn't come home until almost October. And so I get back from Wyoming, and that October, I was really busy with a lot of other stuff, didn't go out and get the wood. And that December, I started cutting that wood up for firewood. So it was out for a little over half a year, and it was completely punked out. There was spalting all through, which made it really pretty for carving, but it was rotted. The wood was rotted. And every time we tried to burn that stuff, it would just make smoke and sizzle and pop, and not really produce a lot of flame. On the other hand, if I cut an oak tree down and I chop that up, I buck it up into logs, and I preferably split them like I did the birch, and I stack that, even out in the outdoors, usually it will season out after a year or two and burn just fine, and it won't likely rot. Oak takes a while to rot because it has a high tannin level in the wood, which can produce some pretty acrid smoke in its own right, but that tannin helps prevent decomposition. Specifically, white oak burns seasons out really well in outdoor conditions. In all situations, we want to try and cover our firewood whenever we got it stacked or put away. We want to cover it away from the water and the elements. But when we're selecting the wood from the land that we need to burn, we got to choose the trees very selectively. We got to be very critical of what wood we're using. And so often what I'll do before I cut the tree down completely is I'll take an axe or I'll take my chainsaw and I'll cut a chunk out of it. Just a little piece, not deep into the wood, just a piece of it. And I'll examine that wood. If it looks like cork or it looks like sponge cake, I'm leaving it alone. It's not going to burn very well. If it was really dense and hard to chop into or really hard to cut that piece out, I'm going to look at it really carefully because that's probably going to be some pretty good wood. And it may be wet, but if I chop it up, I buck it up, cut into logs, firewood length logs, and I split them and I let them dry in the sun or under the awning of a cabin or indoors, usually it'll become very good firewood, very serviceable firewood very, very quickly. So first and foremost, we're looking for dead standing hardwood, preferably maple, ash, oak, hickory, things like that, preferably not birch. But if that's all we got, that's all we got, and we want to get it before it – like if you find fresh killed birch, cut it up immediately. That should be the first wood you cut up and stack and store away is the birch you find. Beyond that, we're looking for the trees. Come November, December, January, it's kind of hard to tell which trees are dead and which trees are alive. There's a few little tricks for that. If you take a shaving off of the wood and you put it on your tongue, and it feels like it sticks to your tongue immediately, it's pretty dry wood, right? That's going to be pretty seasoned wood because it's so dry, it's sucking the water out of your tongue's spit and sticking to you. If it kind of just floats in your mouth and doesn't really stick to anything, chances are it's got a lot of water content in it. It's either green wood, which you'll notice as you peel the bark back on the tree when you're shaving it with your knife or your axe, or it's really, really wet firewood that's dead. That's when you start to have to examine it. There's a phrase out there that dead wood snaps. Hence the phrase snap wood when we're gathering kindling from tree branches. Dead wood snaps. That's not the case in cold weather. Green wood, fresh, live wood will break just as easily as seasoned wood in the wintertime. It'll snap just as easily because it's full of water molecules that are now made brittle from freezing. And if you bend it, it'll snap. So you have to examine the bark, examine the wood. Is it green? Is it fresh looking? Does the bark adhere to the wood very well? These are signs that it's probably still green. Okay? So keep that in mind. Beyond that, if it does stick to our tongue, it's kind of almost glued to you and you got to peel it off your tongue, chances are that's pretty dry wood. So now we've got some good dry seasoned firewood. We safely fell the tree. We safely buck it into logs that are firewood length. We're going to haul it out to our wood stove, haul it to our homestead, haul it back to our camp, wherever we're going to be burning the wood. And we're going to want to split the wood. There's a few reasons we want to split wood. We don't want to burn wood in the round or whole for the most part because it's going to take a while for that to actually combust. The reason for that is all the fibers are whole. All the fibers are completely contained and it's round. As most people know, round things are more aerodynamic than flat things. If you try to blast heat against a wall, that wall absorbs all that heat really, really fast. So if I took a blowtorch and walked up to a board of wood, piece of plywood, and I put a blowtorch to it, all that flame is getting dissipated across the surface of that board and it's absorbed into that board and it'll start to smoke and smolder and potentially start to glow red with coals very, very rapidly. Whereas if I take a tennis ball because it'll probably explode, but a round ball of wood, like if I carve a ball of wood and I stick that on a skewer and I hold that same blowtorch, you'll see the flames kind of dance around that ball. They're going to eventually the middle will start to burn, but not all of it as quickly as the flat piece. So when we split wood, we're increasing the surface area, making flat facets that can be fully exposed to the heat and burn much more rapidly as the whole surface absorbs the heat and begins to off-gas its resins, rosins, and other volatile gases, creating fire. The other reason we want to split the wood, other than just surface area to make it easier to burn, is when we break open all those fibers, we help release more of the water. We want the wood that we burn to be at least 25% water content or less. When we do a water analysis on wood, you can get these hydrometer spikes you basically stick into your piece of firewood, and it says like 35% water, don't burn that. If it says 25%, okay. You can start preparing to burn that stuff. If it's like 15%, oh boy, that's good firewood to burn. That's going to burn really bright, really hot, really fast. So we want a lower water content in our firewood to make it burn efficiently and safely and give us as much heat value as it can, as many BTUs as possible. So splitting it allows us to get better surface area of heat absorption into the wood than a solid round log. And it's going to dry the wood faster, which can benefit A, if we're just stacking it for the winter. If we stack it round, there's a better chance it could potentially rot or at least not dry out very fast. But if we split it and stack it, it's going to dry out much faster and not hold as much water. So splitting the wood to store it or splitting the wood to burn is a better option than trying to burn it round. On the other hand, if I'm trying to get a long burning fire for the whole night, that's when I start putting in large round chunks of wood. And interestingly enough, even though when we cut down a tree, most people look at like the trunk of the tree as their firewood, the branches are actually denser than the trunk itself. All that fiber that you see in the trunk has to basically divide itself up and compress itself into all those branches in the canopy. So all those branches are actually very, very compressed fiber. And the denser the wood is, the longer it burns and the hotter it burns because it's storing more BTUs. So if we're looking at a big oak tree that we cut down, it was standing dead, had all of its branches still for the most part. Some of them may have broken off from a little bit of decomposition. We cut that oak tree down. We cut the logs, the trunk up into logs, and then we get to the branches. Some people will just leave those tops because that's what they see the lumber industry do. They see the lumber industry cut down trees and take the trunks and leave the branches in piles, which called offcut or discard piles. Those discard piles are actually the better firewood. Back in 2008, when we first started building Camp Mud, a wood cutting company came in and cut a ton of firewood in our community. They cut a lot of lumber. Hundreds, if not thousands, of trees were cut down in a very, very short time frame, about 6 months. And we lost a lot of wood to them. And in that time frame, they left a bunch of piles of offcuts, the branches, the canopies, the tops of the trees that would not mill very well because they're such small pieces of wood, often very twisty and kinky, but also the fact that they're just such small diameter pieces, they're not really of any value to the lumber industry. They were there for logs. So what we did for the next 3 years was go through those top piles and cut it all up with our handsaws, bring it back to camp. And we had very, very good burning fires that would last a long time with wrist thick, forearm thick, sometimes as big around as our calves. These pieces of wood, all the way down to two finger thick piece of wood, would burn longer than any of the split wood that we added to the fire as well, because they were dense compressed fiber. Really interesting aspect of firewood. Cut the branches up and use those for your wood stove as much as you're going to want to split up the big round chunks of the trunk. Start off with those branches. Get them trimmed up, limb them up, cut them into serviceable firewood lengths, and get those in the wood pile first. So we've cut our tree down, we've bucked it into logs, we've hauled those back to camp, and we're starting to split them. The other reason we want to split them and potentially even do something more is because the bark layer of the wood is what actually, of the tree, is actually what helps retain water. It's kind of like our skin. If you take a first aid course, it'll explain to you that your skin is meant to keep the outside dry and the inside wet. Bark is the skin of the tree. And so every time we're cutting trees down, if we leave them completely surrounded with bark in the round, the more likely it is to not dry out very quickly. So we want to split the wood is one of the easiest ways. But if you're dealing with those branches I just mentioned, using branches for firewood, they are really difficult to split safely unless you're using a hatchet and with special flick techniques to actually split through the kindling without getting your fingers in the way, whether it's a chicken stick or splitting together, which is where you hold the wood to the bit of the hatchet or axe, lifting them together and dropping them together onto the chopping block. Or if it's just too thin or you just don't want to take the time to split that wood because you'd rather have solid round pieces of wood, a very simple Norwegian trick and Swedish trick or Scandinavian trick is to take your axe and peel the bark off one side of the branch. It doesn't have to be all the way around, at least a 1-inch wide strip of bark removed. That's one of the easiest ways to help get the water content out, because now the bark has a split in it and all that water content in the cambium layer has an escape route other than just the ends of the cross cuts across your sawn log or your bucked log or branch. So now they have all this room to get the water out faster. Another part of how we dry our wood is how we stack it. There's an old adage in Scandinavia, as well as in parts of much of Canada. One of the rules of thumb that they'll tell you is the wood stacking requires the space between each piece of wood just big enough to let a mouse run through it. Basically, a mouse should be able to run through your entire wood pile or your wood stack without being infringed upon. And the reason for that is that air can flow between the pieces of wood and dry it out. Think about if we were trying to dehydrate food in a food dehydrator, whether it's a solar dehydrator, an electric dehydrator, or what have you. You don't want everything right against each other, butted up against each other. You want it spread out enough to let the air flow. Same thing with firewood. So when we stack wood, we don't want it to be like almost like masonry, right? We want to have some gaps. We want to have the gaps big enough to let air get in, but not so big that it makes the wood pile unsafe. So a few ways we can go about stacking the wood. The classic straight stack or horizontal stack that most people are used to seeing, where you have basically a wall of firewood. It could be going from left to right, north, south, however you want to describe it. And what you're going to do is you're going to lay down a layer of wood that is kind of your sacrificial wood. That stuff is what's going to be making contact with the ground. And again, ground is where water is. So I'll often, if I'm stacking firewood at the camp, all those branches that are just too small to use for firewood, or if I have to clear a bunch of saplings out of the way to fell the tree safely, I will make a pile, not a pile, but a platform on the ground. And that stuff will rot before my firewood can. When I'm stacking wood at home, I put it on top of pallets that I got from hardware stores, at Home Depot, things like that, from trucking companies. Whenever things get delivered on pallets, I take those pallets and I stack my firewood on them. And that's going to do two things. First off, it's going to be the sacrificial wood that we let the water content get into and rot instead of our firewood. But also, because it's lifting our wood up and elevating it off the ground, air can flow underneath it. So that's the first thing I'll do is I'll lay a platform down. It could be a long platform made of logs or poles, or it could be a long platform made of pallets, whatever you got. Some people will just put a tarp down. That's okay. I find, though, when you put a tarp down, no matter how well you cover the thing, the tarp will collect water. There will be water deposits on that tarp. But also, because it's kind of like cling wrap or plastic wrap around the bottom of your pieces of firewood, that area doesn't dry out very well, and that's where you start seeing mold and mildew and eventually full-blown rot. So I prefer to elevate with pallets or planks of wood or branches or poles, whatever I've got. Whatever you got that's going to help elevate and keep it off the wet, cold ground, first and foremost. And once that's done, I'm going to try and put some braces on the ends. What I like to do at camp is I'll find two trees of a certain distance. Let's say they're 15 feet apart, that are on good level ground between each other. And I will put down all my branches or poles or my pallets between those two trees in a length, right? From one tree to the other. And those two trees are gonna become braces to hold my firewood in the stack and not let them fall apart easily. If I don't have fire trees standing up that I can use as braces, I'll drive poles into the ground that are about as high, about a foot taller, if not 2 feet taller than the intended pile will be or the stack will be. So I will make my stack with braces, and those braces, whether it's trees or poles, or heck, it could be an entire frame that I build where one side could be a wall of a cabin and the other side a railing, whatever it may be, that's going to help keep the stack from starting to tumble apart. When the wind comes, as you start taking some firewood off the pile, it starts to get kind of loose. It's not going to all collapse and become a danger. Holding the two ends, the left and right ends of your wood stack, helps when having those braces. It really helps hold everything together. And once that's done, I'm going to start stacking fairly large pieces with the bark side down, preferably, so that if there is any risk of it being wet, it's going to be bark that makes contact with that wet, not the wood itself. I actually prefer to peel the bark off my firewood before I stack it as best as I can. It's really difficult to do that in the fall and winter, though. Late spring, early summer, that's when you can shuck bark off of a tree like a banana peel. But this time of year in November, it's really challenging to get the bark to come off. So I don't always do it, but when I have the opportunity, I do. So bark side facing down, I make the first layer. And I'm going to make sure that first layer, that platform, that base I'm making of firewood is very, very stable. I should be able to walk across it like a dock on a lake or a bridge. It should be as solid as possible. That's the foundation of my wood stack. And if my firewood stack has an unstable base, the whole thing will be unstable. These are the pieces that I might even stuff some chunks of wood in between, like wedges, to hold the whole thing really solid. Then we're going to start laying our pieces on top, almost like bricks, but we want to make sure there's little tiny gaps in between. Again, just big enough to let a mouse run through. And we're going to start layering them up. And we want to make sure that's not leaning forward or backwards. We want to keep this as level as possible. I know some folks, when they stack their wood, will go as far as to bring a level with them and set a level on top every time they put a stack up, and they check the level and the angle as they go. Other people, like myself, will just take a plumb. And so what a plumb is you take a piece of cord, hang it from way above, way high, and then you have a weight on the other end of the cord, and you hang it just a couple of inches off the ground. And that weight guides straight vertical to gravity, right? So that string will always be perfectly vertical. And I'll use that as a guide of my wood stack. If it starts leaning away from the string, starts leaning too much into the string, I know that I'm going too far forward or backwards. And so I'll use that string as a guide as I stack up. The number one rule we have to make is no matter how much we think it's a cool idea, we don't stack wood higher than your eyes. Some people won't stack it higher than their chest. That's a very safe option to do. The better you stack, the better efficient or the more efficient or the more well-trained you are and experienced in stacking wood, the higher you can stack that wood wall. But I would not personally ever take it higher than your nose. I keep mine around my shoulder height or lower simply because you don't want to walk up to that wood pile, grab a chunk of wood and imbalance the whole pile and it come down on you, right? And you don't want to have a kid running by and bump into the wood stack and it fall over on them. You don't want to hurt anybody with your wood pile. And it does happen at least once or twice a year in the world. People get hurt by their wood stack falling over, whether it's actually being crushed and actually being like piled over with all their wood because they stacked it too high, or more likely and most commonly is a chunk of hardwood dropping on your foot when you're not wearing steel toe boots and breaking your toes. Whatever it may be, the lower the stack is, the safer it will be. So once we know how to stack safely and efficiently, that's just the straight stack. There's just a straight wall stack. There's other ways. In Scandinavia, what's really common is they'll put a grid of poles on the ground, of saplings. So you'll have some going left or right, and then another pile on top of them going front to back, like the number or pound sign, or what's now known as a hashtag. And you'll have that platform made, and then you'll start stacking the wood kind of like how you would build an igloo in a spiral, up to about chest high. And then all the branches and offcuts and real weird pieces that came off get thrown into the middle. So it looks like a donut, and then you fill it with brush, like with a brushier or less balanceable pieces of wood get thrown into the middle to help hold the inside. And then they'll take a tarp and throw it over the entire cover or the entire top of the firewood pile and stake down the ends at angles so that there's airflow getting up into the wood stack. Other people will do the same round stack method and then cover that very top with brush that arches it. So it's almost like a dome, like a domed roof. And then when they put the tarp on, it's doming as well and shedding rain and snow very quickly. But also, again, air can get up and into the wood stack and dry the wood out. I have found that method to be a lot more space saving, a lot more efficient with space. If you have, let's say, a quarter acre property homestead that you've set up, you don't want to be filling up a third of your quarter acre with wood stacked in a wall. You don't want to be taking up a lot of room. So you can make these round stacks and have a cord of wood here, a cord of wood there, a cord of wood over there, all over the place, spread out and not taking up too much space at all. But what's a cord of wood? So a bush cord, or sorry, a cord of wood, or what's often referred to as a full cord or bush cord of wood, is a neatly stacked pile of wood that is 4 feet wide, 4 feet tall, and 8 feet long. Okay? So 4 by 4 by 8, or 128 cubic feet. All right? That is what's referred to as a bush cord or full cord. A face cord is 1/3 of that. So it'll be 4 feet by 8 feet and 16 inches deep. So you have like a stack of wood instead of multiple layers of stacks or multiple depths of stacks, where you'll have one stack of wood, they're 16-inch long logs or pieces of firewood stacked 4 feet high and 8 feet long. That is a face cord of wood, all right? That's 1/3. If we take that measurement and go two more rows deep, that will make approximately 4 feet or a full cord. Now, to understand what we're trying to achieve by stacking the wood, other than just how to store it, is we're trying to season the wood. Seasoning the wood is going to do several things. First off, you're going to lose water content, and the less water content, the drier the wood will be, and therefore the more efficient it will burn, with less creosote deposits in your wood stove, your stove pipe, your chimney, your fireplace, etc. The second thing it's going to create is the fact that the wood is actually going to become denser. When wood is full of water, it's kind of like a sponge. When wood is lacking of water, it's like a board of wood. It's like a solid chunk of material, and therefore it's going to burn longer. in theory. It's going to burn brighter and hotter too. So it depends, it's going to depend on the species of wood. When I'm looking at the Norwegian wood chopping, stacking, and drying wood, the Scandinavian Way book by Lars Meiting, back in the rate of drying for birch, he's got a little table set up. And in here, it breaks down from 2 days to 6 months. And then every category from there is including loosely stacked, good circulation of firewood in the sun, loosely stacked, some circulation in the sun, so less circulation. There are the gaps between the piece of firewood are maybe a little smaller, and maybe it's not as loosely stacked. And then tightly stacked, some circulation in the shade. Okay? So at the six-month period for loosely stacked, good circulation in the sun birch, you're going to have 16.9% water content. In loosely stacked, some circulation sun, you'll have 18.1% water content. So more water content. Whereas tightly stacked, some circulation in the shade, you're going to have 20.6% water content. And again, the higher the percentage, the less it's going to burn efficiently, the more likely it will rot, and the more likely it will make creosote deposits in your wood stove. So take that into consideration. Beyond that, let's go into the millions of British thermal units of different species. In here, he's got a list of species going from holly to western cedar. You can go onto almost any search engine and type in wood list BTUs, and you'll find everything from hop hornbeam to maple and what their BTUs are. This is the list that he has. So in the millions of British thermal units, I'm just going to go down the list for birch, since we were just talking about birch. I'm going to scroll over to the American cord. So if you have one cord of firewood stacked, so 4 feet tall, 4 feet deep, and 8 feet long, you will have 21.96 million British thermal units, or million BTUs. So 21.96 million BTUs of potential energy in that stack. Whereas we look at something like, let's see down his list, oak. So that was 21.96. Oak, in the same measurement of one American cord, 4 foot by 4 foot by eight, has 24.16 million BTUs. So it's burning much hotter, much hotter. Well over 3 million BTUs hotter. Now let's jump over to another species. We have hickory. Hickory is very common in Ontario in the American East. We have hickory that's shagbark hickory, shellbark hickory, pignut hickory, yada, 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 yada. Bitternut hickory, there's a whole bunch of different species. Going back to birch, we have 21.96 million BTUs. Hickory has 28 million BTUs per American cord. And the next one higher is hornbeam, which is ironwood, 28.99 million BTUs per American cord, 4 foot by 4 foot by 8 foot. The only one that burns hotter than that is holly, which we don't really have a lot of holly in Canada. It's not a very common wood we have here in at least Eastern Ontario, Central Ontario, the boreal forest. That one burns at 29.65 million BTUs, according to his charts, largest charts in this book. I can jump onto my phone real quickly, though, and look at the, I believe it was the Utah State University. Let me just pull that up real quickly. I'm going to jump over here real quick. All right, here we go. So alder for a cord of wood, American cord, remember 4 foot by 4 foot by eight, alder wood has 17.5 million BTUs. White ash has 24.2, hotter than birch. 24.2 million BTUs. We look at aspen, quaking aspen or trembling aspen, or what some people just refer to as poplar, you have 18.2. It doesn't burn anywhere as hot as hickory or oak. Even worse off basswood or linden. That one burns at 13.8 million BTUs per cord of wood. Beech burns very hot, 27.5. And beech is actually one of my favorite woods to burn if you can find it. Sadly, in Ontario, beech bark fungus is killing a lot of our beech trees, wiping a lot of them out. There's even some beliefs that by 2050, we will not have American beech in Ontario anymore, sadly. But that means that there's a lot of dead beech out there that you could be burning for firewood. And it burns at around 27.5 million BTUs per cord of wood. If we jump down to something like cherry, a very common tree in my area for firewood, 20.4. Pretty humble, less than birch, nowhere close to as hot as hickory or a hornbeam, but it still burns hotter than your basswoods and your poplars. All right, so we've kind of gone over seasoning and stacking our wood and all these things. And we've got kind of covered the idea of like what to do if you just got to the place you need to get firewood, like finding dead wood. Let's talk about if we need to get wood for the future. We're stockpiling our firewood for the future. First and foremost, the best time of year to get firewood is in the wintertime to cut down trees for firewood. There's a few reasons for that. First off, there's a lot less life up in the canopy, and therefore there's less likelihood that A, there's going to be a lot of hangups. There's still the possibility, but it's less. But B, you can see the top of the tree that you're dropping. When it's full of leaves, it's really hard to see which way it's leaning. It's hard to see what kind of obstructions there may be, so it's safer. It's more efficient. But the other benefit is when it's the dormant stage of the tree's growth, there's less water in the wood, and therefore it'll season faster. So if we're going to be choosing a time of year to cut firewood, the less water in the wood is best. And that is going to happen in the wintertime, December, January, February. That's the best time of year to cut firewood. The worst time of year is when the sap is flowing the heaviest. So for, of course, in the case of cutting maple wood, you really don't want to cut it down during the sugar bush season when they're running, you know, gallons upon gallons of sap up their trunk. Not a good time to try and get dry firewood. Another good example is in early summer, late spring, when the trees are so flush with water, you can peel the bark off them almost effortlessly. Again, there's a lot of water content in the wood at that time. And so we want to aim for winter. Winter is the best time to cut firewood. If we can't do that, let's say we bought a homestead and we moved in May. Well, it's not winter time and there's a lot of sap in that wood. How can we make it the less wet as possible? Wait until it's the furthest from a full moon as possible. It sounds esoteric. I know it sounds kind of like an old wives' tale, but there's no arguing the fact that full moons have more draw on water. Look at the tides. They're strongest around a full moon. Same thing with the trees. There's going to be more pull of water up into the xylem and phloem or cambium, the inner bark, the living tissue of the tree, up into the trunk and into the branches during a full moon. So we want to cut back on that. We want to cut our trees down. If we have to cut them during the growing season, we want to cut them when they're the furthest from a full moon as possible. So that's another thing. The next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to first start off, let's say it's May. I've got my property. I moved on. I've got to get a lot of work done here. I got to get a farm started up. I got to make sure the livestock are okay. I got to fix up the house. I got to fix up the barns. I got to fix up everything and maybe even start building new stuff. I might not have time to cut a lot of firewood. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to find all the dead standing trees, just like we talked about before. I'm going to cut them. I'm going to buck them. I'm going to stack them after splitting and store them in dry locations in the sun or up at least near the house where there's a good airflow, as we talked about earlier. Then I'm going to start selecting hardwoods that are going to dry pretty rapidly. Things like ash, things like birch, things like maple. You don't want to necessarily do this with oak. You don't necessarily want to do this with hickory. They're denser wood, and therefore it's going to take longer for them to dry out. And what I'm going to do is one of several options. I can cut them down right then and there and stack them right out in the sun with no cover, and then at night cover them every night with a tarp of some sort to keep the dew and the rain off them. But every day it's sunny, keep them completely exposed, and that can speed up the curing process and the seasoning process. But I could also... with that, I may have to even restack once in a while so that the stacks that are furthest from the sun get out in the front and get exposed to the sun again. That can take a lot of work. So we're talking about trying to cut back on work. That's not really helping. Another option that can be done is let's say we've stockpiled enough dead wood that we've gotten out of the bush in May, June, and we've stacked it and we've cut a few trees down. They're going to burn pretty good if we get them cured and seasoning now. We just need like 6 months to get them going. Birch, ash, maple, those kinds of woods. We can get them kind of good at burning. Not going to be too wet. They're going to be about 20% water content in about 6 months. So we have May, so June, July, August, September, October, November. Bam, that's 6 months. They should start burning well now. So most of October, when it's getting cold, I'll burn the dead wood. And then as we come into November, I can mix in some of that less seasoned wood that I just cut down. What I'm also going to do is I'm going to girdle trees. I'm going to select trees that are safe to fall in the summertime. And I'm going to select them, and I'm going to select them for all the safe methods. Remember, we have to know how to fell these trees safely before we ever do any of this stuff. I'm not going to dive too far into how to fell this wood or cut this wood up. I'm telling you how to select the wood. And what we're going to do is we're going to observe it all, consider it, find the right trees that we know we can cut down safely later or leave standing for now. And what we're going to do is we're going to purposely kill them. I'm going to go along with an axe or a saw, and I'm going to girdle the tree. I'm going to go around the entire base of the tree, and I'm going to sever the bark all the way down to the sapwood, cutting through the cambium, also known as the xylem and the phloem, all the way through into the sapwood. I'm going to cut through and sever the connection from the roots to the branches. And now what's going to happen is, over the next several months, hopefully throughout the whole summer, these trees are going to continue to breathe. And through their breathing process, they're going to transpire water. And what transpiring is basically the water from the roots gets drawn up through the trunk, up into the branches, and into the leaves. And some of that water evaporates into the atmosphere around the tree throughout the whole canopy. That's what I'm going for here, because now I've severed the headwaters in a sense. I've cut the tap off, and there's just water left in the pipes. And all I got to do is get that water out of the pipes. So as I go around, I ring the tree, I girdle the tree, all the water from the trunk up into the branches is going to slowly move its way into the leaves, and through photosynthesis, transpire and evaporate and leave the tree. And we're going to notice from the very top of the crown, eventually we're going to start seeing die-off. Usually around mid-July to late July, you're going to start seeing crown die-off. The very top of the tree, the leaves start to get kind of crispy, they start to shrivel up, and by mid-August, they're fully brown and they're falling off like it's autumn. And then the lower branches start to do the same thing as the tree runs out of water. And if we're lucky, this all happens well before fall or autumn, and the tree just continues to dry out in that time. What I can do to speed that process up is peel as much of the bark off the tree as I can and make sure that the trunk is also exposed to the sun. And so in a sense, I have vertical cordwood. I'm leaving it standing, and I know where these trees are. I mark them off. I make sure anybody that comes onto the property is aware of where these trees are, and they are fully girdled, and they are dying slowly and drying as they die. The reason this is safer, some people say that's really dangerous, and it is. There is no way that leaving a tree standing dead is safe, okay? The reason I argue that this is a good tactic, if you do it properly and you know all of your safe felling procedures, is this wood, you know when it died. You know when this tree died. You have a timeline. That dead wood that we've been cutting in the woods this whole time, those trees could have been dead for a year, 3 years, 10 years. We don't know. And that's why there's so much risk involved with felling dead trees, because the core could be rotted out and you have no knowledge of that. The sapwood could be rotted and you don't know until you cut into it. And now you have these risks that we call widow makers. But if I cut an ash tree, if I cut an ash tree down that I girdled 9 months prior, I know that that wood has been exposed to the elements, drying out in those nine months. Now, in comparison, if I cut that tree down when it's green, soaking, sopping wet in June or May, and I cut it all up and I stack it, well, all that water is trapped inside the lumber, inside the wood, and it's going to sit there and it's going to have to dry out and season. And it's going to have a lot more hard time than if I just left it standing. And so now I have dead wood that I cut down and bucked into lumber and split into firewood and stacked. And then I have all that green wood that's maples, ash, birch, that only needs 6 to 7 months of curing, of seasoning. Those have also been stacked. But in that time, any hickories that I need to drop, any elms that I might drop, any oaks that I might drop, those denser trees that are going to take a long time to season anyways, I'm giving myself a head start for next season. I may not be able to use girdled wood this winter, but I have a head start on making sure that when I get to next spring, that wood can be cut down and it's already very well seasoned. And by the time winter comes again, that stuff's ready to go. And now I have a bit of a head start, a jump start on getting wood for 2 years down the road, 3 years down the road, 5 years down the road. So that's the tactics that we have. We can cut trees in winter when they have the least amount of water content, or we can girdle the trees or cut down trees that we know season fast. And what I'm going to do if I'm cutting down like maple, ash, and birch in the spring, in May, June, is when I cut those trees down, I'm going to completely peel them, because the less bark, the faster it dries, right? That's what we got to remember here, is we're trying to dry and season this wood out as best as possible and as soon as possible, okay? So now we have, you know, dry wood for this winter. We have dry wood for next season. We have all this wood getting stockpiled around the property. And we have kindling style softwoods like pine and cedar and spruce and whatnot. And we have harder, denser woods. And we know what kind of dense woods we want, what kind of hardwoods we want. We know the BTU values of these trees. Where you go with this knowledge is the next step. You have to learn to work with this stuff. There's going to be a lot of trial and error. There's going to be a lot of what we call dirt time working with this knowledge of how to cut firewood and how to stack and store the firewood so it dries the best. You will probably lose a cord of wood in the next couple of years to rot. That's going to happen. The goal is to make that as little impact as possible. If you can lose a cord of wood over 10 years, that's better than losing a cord of wood in 1 year, right? So learning how to stack your wood, learning how to peel the bark, learning how to identify the right trees and know what kind of conditions they need to season in and cure in and get ready to become firewood. And then as you perfect your skills, you learn how to work with your wood stove or your fireplace or your bonfire or your external wood furnace, whatever it may be. And these stockpiles of wood, there's a true joy in cutting firewood. There's this old like motto that firewood can warm you twice, cutting it and burning it. There's even some folks that'll say it warms you thrice or three times, cutting it, hauling it, and burning it. And that's true. But there's also this sense of accomplishment and sense of success and sense of security when you look out from your yard having a morning coffee or from your tent and you see a big stack of firewood and you see the smoke pumping out of your chimney or your stovepipe. There's a real happy feeling when you see wood stacked, ready to burn, to keep you and your loved ones warm, to cook many meals over, to dry a lot of your wet clothes when you're tromping around in the bush, and just everything else you need in life. Firewood is in many ways an antidepressant. It is in many ways great entertainment. And learning all you can about the trees and their values and their uses and their benefits extends beyond just, you know, filling up the wood stack and making sure you got some firewood for the year. You're going to understand these trees better. You're going to understand the environment they're from better. I know a lot of woodcutters who truly love the trees on their property, and they'll walk through the woods and touch certain trees that they won't cut down just quite yet because that tree is so important for the future. And they're the ones that are planting trees that they'll never enjoy the shade under. That's the beauty of woodcutting. That's the beauty of firewood and learning how to do woodlot management and how to take care of the forest and make biodiversity happen. That all comes with this all. But we got to start off with knowing how to cut the wood first and learning what the value is. And that all comes from time, practice, experience, and some failure. So I hope this year when you're cutting or sawing through a chunk of kindling and getting it ready to kindle up the fire, get the fire lit up, you remember all these little messages that I passed on to you, that have been passed on to me by my father, my uncle, my grandmother, my friends, my neighbors, all these tips and tricks that I've learned over the years that I'm trying to pass on here. I know that talking for well over an hour about firewood seems a little funny, but it's really one of the most interesting subjects there is out there when it comes to homesteading, bushcraft, survival skills, all those things. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. I know I enjoyed recording it, even though it seems really peculiar to be so excited to talk about firewood. And I hope you picked up some new tips and tricks for yourself. Even if you didn't, I hope you enjoyed the episode. And I want to thank all of you. I want to thank our patrons like Paul McCarney, Renee Nolting, Sammy Tangier, Sarah Quirno, or Sarah Q, and everybody else that's out there tuning in. I hope you really enjoyed this episode. Thank you for supporting us. And we'll be coming back out next week with another episode.